Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. Starting a little bit late is the TechNet, the 1753 edition of the TechNet, which started back in 1982, 36 going on 37 years ago. As you guys have heard so often, you know the main reason for the TechNet is that the curious radio amateurs gather at this time and teach each other wireless techniques. And the reason the TechNet is so popular, in my opinion, is because there's so darn many people willing to contribute to what they've learned. The books do a mediocre job, the classes do a mediocre job of teaching wireless techniques, what really happens. You really want somebody who understands wireless equipment, you got to hire a ham radio operator, because they've got the passion. They live with it day to day, and they talk about it with their friends, and pass information back and forth, and learn all the rules of thumb and the hidden secrets, so to speak. And boy, there's a lot of them. How radio really works. I'm still amazed. Let me drop. I'm still amazed that 10-watt transmitter used by the Apollo astronauts on Apollo 15 and 16, while I was listening to them, 10-watt transmitter on the moon, a quarter of a million miles away. They transmitted that signal into their antenna. Not one single electron left that antenna. It transmitted a wave. It created a magnetic field. That wave went across the hard vacuum of space between Earth and Moon, came down to the 12-foot diameter dish that I had set up in Farmingdale to listen to the 2,287 megasonical signal from the command service module. How in the world does that signal do that? I mean, we learn how our antennas work in the transmit mode and the receive mode by experience. We can calculate how strong the signal is going to be when you know the frequency and the distance and the effective capture area of the antenna and the gain of the transmitting antenna and the power output of the transmitter and the receiver sensitivity. You put it all together and it's predictable. But what really moves through space? A radio wave. It's got a word. It's got a name. By some magic, that signal gets there. The real magic is the NASA spacecraft Voyager out there 12 billion miles, three times the distance of Pluto. Again, a 10-watt transmitter. It takes something like 17 hours one way at the speed of light for that signal to get from Voyager down to the Earth. Here we are since 1977, I think, is when that was launched. And we're still talking to that spacecraft, and it's still communicating with us. 12 billion miles. How in the world does that signal go that far without getting tired? That's some of the stuff that we discuss on the TechNet. Let me drop. The TechNet's broken up into three sections. The first section, for a little over an hour usually, is where people sign in because they do have a question or a comment for the net. They give me their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means they do have a question or a comment. You need that sign in because you're listening. After 36 going on 37 years, we believe somebody is listening. The second section of the TechNet is done by Dr. Roy, AC2GS, who handles the mailbag and the science talk. He's got some interesting puzzles he'll be asking you tonight, physics-like puzzles. And the third section is by Paul, WS2N, with a space report. And some interesting launches have happened by NASA and other space agencies, and more launches are on the way, and he'll be telling you about that. Let me drop. Okay, so at this time we're going to take check-ins by people who do have a question or comment. You're going to give me your call letters. Try to remember to give me your name and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this. WS2N, Paul, and yes. So if you want to check in, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RAW listening.
K2MAR, yes. Question for the net, Todd, K2CJP.
Okay, that was a double. MAR Gabe, you got covered up. What is your prefix of MAR, Gabe? Go ahead.
Kilo Bravo. Kilo Bravo.
Okay, Kilo Bravo to MAR. And the next one was, I think it was Todd, KC2 Juliet Bravo. Do I have you correct there, Todd?
Negative. Call sign is Kilo 2 Charlie Juliet Papa.
Okay, Kilo 2 Charlie Juliet Papa. We got you, Todd. And you also check in, give me your call letters and name right now.
K2RLW, Bob.
WA2RYY, Joe, yes.
Okay, we got Bob and Joe. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KD2NVV, Bob, yes.
I presume that Kilo Delta 2, November, Victor Bravo. Is that correct, Bob?
Yes, that's correct. KD2NVV, November, Victor Bravo.
Okay, we got more than enough to get started. So let's go over to Gabe first. Kilo Bravo 2. Mike Alpha Romeo, you've got it, Gabe.
This is Goofy Boy on the net tonight, and I have a question regarding a Honda EU7000IS inverter generator. Engine has a Honda GX390, and I'm curious. I use 15W40 synthetic oil in my snowblower, lawnmower, etc. I was wondering if I could use the same weight oil for the generator, because the reason why I'm choosing that heavier weight is because the engine's an air-cooled engine, obviously, and in the summertime it gets really hot, and the 30 weight or 10W30 was thin in an air-cooled engine. Manufacturer always says use 10W30 or straight 30 or 5W30. That's for the 1540. I was just wondering if anyone on frequency has ever used that weight oil on a generator engine, Honda, specifically Honda GX390 engine. K2RW, this is KB2MAR.
Yeah, I personally have lots of opinions on this particular subject, Gabe. But before I give you my opinions, let's see if other people on the frequency.
KD2AMZ, for comment.
KD2AMZ, go right ahead with your comment.
You've just voided your warranty. The manufacturer says use the appropriate type oil, whatever it is, and you use something different, and your engine seizes or blows up or anything happens, or if you bring it in for service and they see it's the wrong oil, you've just voided your warranty.
I think it's Mike. Mike, how sure are you that that voids the warranty?
100% sure, KD2AMZ. If you read your warranty, if you say you do anything other, in particular when it says change oils in any internal combustion, you void your warranty. Before you do that, you better contact the manufacturer and read the fine print.
Okay, that's the manufacturer supplied information. And the chances of the engine blowing up and you really needing the warranty, in my opinion, if you're treating it in a reasonable manner, that's a fairly low probability. Now, whenever I have the oil in my car changed, I do it once per year, whether it needs it or not. And the garage doing the changing will quite often say, gee, how come your oil looks so clean? Do you change it every 1,000 miles? No, I change it probably once per year, which sometimes is 10,000 miles. What's unique about that? I intentionally use 30-weight, non-multigrade oil. The reason for that, and the reason why you have to change the oil frequently, is that the multigrade oil contains something that's called a coagulant. In other words, when the oil heats up, it becomes more dense because of that substance in there called coagulant. The coagulant is the stuff that eventually breaks down, turns into sludge, and will gel your engine of your car if you don't change the oil for a whole lot of time. By using 30-weight oil, summer, winter, spring, and fall, I don't have a coagulant, I don't have anything that can break down, I can leave the oil in there for a long period of time. My philosophy on this is that when you start an engine, even on a cold winter day, within 60 seconds, the heat of those pistons heats that oil, and the oil is no longer cold, so the multi-grade oil only gives you a viscosity control for the first 60 seconds or 120 seconds. After that, the rest of the oil is really doing all the work. And you think you're going to have trouble cranking an engine on a cold day with 30-weight oil? I don't believe it. So that's my philosophy. It's a rare one. Not very many people agree with it. But I've been doing it with my cars for the last 20 years, and I don't have oil breakdown problems. And as I said, the garage will often say, how come your oil is so clean looking? So that's a bunch of opinions. My lawnmowers and my snowblower all run on 30-weight, non-multigrade oil. As I said, you tell a garage what you're doing, they will be horrified. You tell a manufacturer of your automobile what you're doing, they'll be horrified. But for me, it works. And that coagulant is more trouble than it's worth, in my opinion. What would you, Gabe? KB2MAR, K2RIW in the TechNet.
a little bit dicky, a lot of static on your signal there. You might want to check your microphone cable or the coax cable. There's a lot of static there, just to let you know that. Yeah, I've been using 15W40, believe it or not, for the past 25 years in the lawnmower. I chose that weight because, like I said before, an air-cooled engine requires, I mean, the oil will go from a 30 weight to a 20 weight at a very high temperature, and air-cooled engines generate a lot of high heat. So I don't understand why manufacturers recommend these fuel economy type oils, because it's a lighter weight, less friction in the engine, because the parts have the oil is thinner, and the parts move more freely. You see a little bit more gas.
Yeah, the
being that it's an air-cooled engine, the gap between the piston rings to the cylinder wall and I don't know about the journal and the connector around the crankshaft, that I don't know about, but I know that there's going to be more space in between the moving parts, so I always get the heavier weight oil, I prefer that one. I was at Fuel Day this year with my Yonkers Amateur Radio Club, and the Office of Emergency Management had the Honda U7000IS running on, I think it was mineral oil, because I've noticed through a couple of hours of operation, like between 7 to 8 hours, I started to smell some oil burning by the muffler area. Not the first 5 or 6 hours, but I'd say about 10, 20, 12 hours after that, you would smell the oil. I'm guessing that the idle oil is trying to run thinner and thinner because it's not synthetic, and it becomes less of a protectant to the engine parts. KTRW is KP2MAR.
Yeah, I'm hearing lots of static on your signal also. That's just the way the repeater is behaving tonight. The crackles you're hearing. In the case of an air-cooled engine, which is running at a higher temperature, the multi-grade oil, the coagulant that's in it, is going to break down sooner and turn into sludge. In my opinion, that's a greater motivation to use 30-weight, non-multi-grade, straight oil. But that's what I use. I don't have troubles with my snowblower, grass cutting machine, lawnmower, and so on, and automobiles. As I said, it's a radical opinion that I've developed and used for 20 years, and it worked for me. But each person I explain it to gets horrified. They think everyone has fallen in love with multi-grade oil. I haven't, as you can tell. And with any further opinions on all of the above, give me a call letters right now, K2RIW and the TechNet. So, Gabe, what's your conclusion right now? I guess you're going to study it a little bit further, but if you dig deep enough into the internet articles, you'll eventually find some articles discussing multi-grade oil and the way they break down, and synthetics, and the very small percentage of people who will put in a non-multi-grade oil, heavy oil, like 30 weight, even in the wintertime. And so, for me, that works. Over to you, Gabe, for any final comments, K2RIW.
By the way, the oil that I use is Redline synthetic oil. They don't use thickeners in that oil, so it doesn't really break down. It's engineered from the ground up. They might use some minor... Well, I've heard that the wider the ratio of the two numbers, the more of a chance they're going to be putting thickeners in that oil. Let's say, for example, for a 0W40 weight oil, you can imagine what they're going to put in there to make that oil thicken to 40 weight. But being that it's a 15W40, the ratio is closer, the numbers. So they would use very little thickener in that oil. So, I don't know. I think it's a fuel economy thing. I bet you the engineer, yes, an engineer for engines, and they'll tell you, you can put that for, especially in the summertime for an air-cooled engine, you can put the heavier weight oil and nothing will happen to the engine. I pretty much guarantee if you ask an automotive engineer, whoever that does that kind of work, they'll tell you that. I mean, that's my opinion there. I was thinking of putting a straight...
I think you said you were thinking of putting in a straight. What do you believe would happen in the wintertime with 30 weight oil and your air-cooled engine? What do you believe would happen, Dave? Go ahead.
Well, basically, with an air-cooled engine, if you have a pool-cord-style air-cooled engine, some of them are dual-purpose, dual electric and pool-cord, there is a splasher on the end of the connecting rod, which will dip into the 30-weight oil, and when you whip that pool-cord out, there's just going to be a giant splash of oil in the engine, and the oil will reach the parts that it's lubricated. So there's not like it has to run through oil galleries in an automotive like a car. Let's say the temperature's 10 degrees out, and you have a straight 30-way oil in a car. The oil might take longer to reach the parts of the car engine rather than the air-cooled engine where there's a splashing type mechanism where it just hits the oil when you pull the pull cord and it splashes the oil to the parts that are lubricated and it's instantaneous.
Comment.
But even with an automobile with channels that the oil has to flow through, there's always some oil left over from the last time you ran the engine. So it's not running dry. And within about 120 seconds, the engine has come up to enough temperature that the oil that's there is being heated. And so it's only for the first 120 seconds that the multigrade is doing you any good, in my opinion. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Yeah, the oil being heavier makes the engine work harder. So the engine working harder to pump oil will heat up. And battering thick oil by forcing it through an engine will cause it to heat by the property of working the oil itself mechanically. So the difference this causes through will be minimal. But it is measurable. So when we compare, let me drop. So when we compare it to a typical heat exchanger, we have a transistor and we have a heat sink for it. If the area, physical area of the heat sink, based on the airflow in this particular point of space, is sufficient enough to cool it down, nothing will happen. So I have to agree with that. But if it's not, because they try to minimize the size of the engine, it will get damaged. It's a friction, it's a heat, it's overheat. And to exceed it.
Everyone is led to believe that a heavy, like 30-weight oil in the wintertime on a cold day is going to make the engine very hard to crank. I think that's almost not true. The cold engine on a cold day with a cold battery, the cold battery's got a higher internal resistance and therefore the starter motor turns at a lower rate and you think it's extra drag of the engine. The majority of the joints in the engine, your rotary joints between the crankshaft and the connecting rods, for instance, there's such an extremely long moment on that. The thickest pasty oil in that joint wouldn't create very much friction. The only real friction is the pistons going up and down. The last time you turned the engine off, the engine was hot, and most of the oil that was in the cylinders drained already down. There's very little oil there. So if you think the engine's going to be hard to crank on a cold day, I don't believe it. It's only because of the cold starter motor and the cold battery. So heavyweight oil all the time, to me, does the job very well. But that's one person's opinion.
Leave your comments.
And not very many people are agreeing with me. Over to you, Wes.
The good thing about cold weather and thick oil is that oil that is supposed to clean up the surfaces of the cylinder is still there. Because it's thick and it's there and it cannot flow down easily. Another good thing is that when it starts to work, although it consumes, the engine consumes more of the fuel, it gets hot faster. So it allows the engine to work better and the lubrication is excellent. So that's my viewpoint about that. Thank you.
Are you saying, Wes, that you use a constant weight heavy oil, even in the wintertime, in your cars? Is that what you're saying?
If you have extra money to pay for fuel, yes, why not? What's a big deal? If the mechanical strength of the parts of the engine is insufficient to handle the load, it will break. Other than that will never break. It will be less used and will have less wear out than the thin one. The only thing is that it is paid by your money to have it and to use it and to exceed it.
Yeah, by what you're saying, you're implying that a heavyweight oil creates more resistance of engine running and therefore you're going to have lower mileage. I think the difference would be very small. And if my 25 miles per gallon engine went down to 23 miles per gallon because I'm using a thick oil, but the thick oil makes the engine last longer, I think that's a very good trade-off. I would go for that one. Okay, we're going to go over to Todd next. K2 Jewel, I think it's Golf Juliet Bravo. Over to you, Todd. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Can I make a comment on...
K2CJP, I think he owes in there. I'll let him go with the Home Depot comment.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, I won't be long. I had a 19 Chevy. I got rid of it when it was 8 years old. I used W all year round, getting some blow-by in the range. So that helped that. And by the way, I did the heads on that engine. 307 Chevrolet Spark Edge.
I understand. Was there someone else who wants to make a comment on this subject? Okay, we're going to go over to Todd. K2GJB, K2RIW. Go ahead, Todd.
I guess everybody's excited here in the cold front. It's Kilowatt 2 Charlie Juliet Papa. Quick question, in and out. Just a quick comment regarding the lawnmower. Call Home Depot, they'll give you the answers. Could anyone recommend the Open Spot 2, what their views are on it? There's so many hot spots out there, and I've been doing a lot of reading, and it's like conflicting. Some people say one thing, some people say the other. Back to you.
Does anyone have a comment on Open Spot 2, whatever the hell that is? Go right ahead.
AC2GS.
Mr. GS, go ahead. Start off with your name. Roy, Dr. Roy, go ahead.
Thank you, Dick. Open Spot 2, as opposed to Open Spot 1, which is made by a company called Shark RF in, I think, Great Britain, is a hot spot for digital modes. What happens is D-Star and Fusion and DMR use internet-based networks. And you can tap into the internet network using hotspots. You still need a handy talkie or a radio that has a vocoder chip in order to do the voice encode decode, but the packets and such can be handled through the hotspot. Open Spot 2 is a very nice product. It's kind of high-end expensive, but it requires the least amount of trouble getting it set up. It works beautifully. It boots up very quickly. I haven't had it get corrupted, which sometimes the Zoom spots and such get corrupted. So I tend to like it, but it is a little on the expensive side.
Any further comments? Or Phil, you've got it, Todd.
K2CJP. Okay, thank you very much, guys. Yeah, I was thinking about going with that. That's what I've been hearing a lot. Expense is not a big thing. I got rid of my wife about 3 years ago, so what I would use on her, I'll use it for myself. Continue, gentlemen. Thank you very much. K2CJP.
Okay, sounds like Todd's happy. We're going to go over to Bob. K2 Romeo Lima Whiskey. You've got it, Bob. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Alright, I don't have any questions. I'm listening in as usual. I admit I've been listening for 10 or 20 years now. But I do have a new antenna, so I'd like anyone to tell me how much better my signal sounds. And that's it. So back to you, Dick. K2IRW, this is K2RLW. Not very confusing. To you.
Very fine, Bob. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and your RLW is just a few licenses later than mine. My license was originally issued as a technician, as a novice class license, February 1956. So I'm guessing yours was issued late spring, early summer of 1956. And you're sounding good. The antenna's working like a charm. Almost everybody who doesn't have a super strong signal tonight has a little bit of scratchies that you hear. If I turn my power down, right now I'm not hearing the scratchies, but from time to time you hear some static in there. That's the repeater tonight, and you've got very little of that, and you're sounding good. Back to you for any further comments, Bob. K2 Romeo Lima Whiskey. To Romeo India Whiskey, listening.
K2RIW, this is K2RLW. Yes, I got my license also towards the end of February. We're at the end of February in 1956. Sure. Okay. Well, I'm happy that I sound good, and there's not too much noise on the thing. And let me turn it over to you about the tech net go on. I've been listening for a long time, and I still listen. And although I don't have things like concerns about oil, I'm curious. So back to you.
Very fine, Bob. Yeah, this is where the curious people gather who are interested in radio, wireless, astronomy, cosmology, physics. people have wide interests. We'll gather here. That's what they've been doing for 36, 37 years. And from time to time, we hear some very nice compliments of the operators of the TechNet saying that people were previously citizen band operators or just using a scanner came across the TechNet, started listening, came to the conclusion that ham radio operators are having a good time. They went out and got a ham license. And so we hear compliments like that from time to time. Next person on our list is Joe. We've got to go easy with this because sometimes he has some pretty tough questions. W-H-R-Y-Y. K-R-I-W, go, Joe.
Okay. A couple of times you've mentioned about the A-squared R preamps, that these things seem to have leakage, or RF leakage through the case compared to the angle preamp. How would you actually test that particular function of what you said? Back to you.
There are various forms of electromagnetic compatibility tests, where you start off with the device on the test in, say, an anechoic chamber. Then you take a, you know, the sniffing loop that you sometimes use to find out if you've got leakage on something. Like you could use a small loop of wire at the end of a piece of semi-rigid coax and put it near the seals of your microwave oven, and the sniffer going into a spectrum analyzer tuned to 24 or 50 megacycles. I think that's the frequency. The frequency of a microwave oven, and you could measure the leakage in the receive mode. Nothing stops you from doing that in the reverse, in the transmit mode, with the right kind of an attenuator from a known transmitter. You can transmit into that sniffer. And then the sniffer being used backwards as a near point source of signal, you could then put it near the joints and near the connectors and whatever and find out whether or not you're getting leakage. Because the cover on a AR squared preamp is just a simple flat sheet of metal held down to an aluminum case by screws that feed through, that method of shielding probably can give you 60 dB of shielding, but you're not going to get very much more than that. Whereas you take the method by which the angle linear preamp is created with its, 10 screws, my guess is that case is closer to 100, 120 dB of shielding, which could be confirmed with that reverse sniffer test. So that's one of many ways. There's various ways that you can create a known E field in volts per meter, amps per meter, milliwatts per square centimeter, whatever system of units you want. There's various ways that you can create an E field, put your amplifier on the test, or your unit, your electronics on the test, into that E field, oriented by rotating around the x-axis, the y-axis, the z-axis, and measure the amount of leakage. So it is definitely a test that has been done in the past, particularly on military equipment. Certain pieces of military equipment need more than 120 dB of shielding. Let me drop them. The most severe case of a shielding requirement I know of is the EA-6B transmitting pods on the EA-6B aircraft. It's an ALQ-99 transmitter manufactured by Airborne Instruments Laboratory. Here you've got roughly a 2-kilowatt transmitter in a jamming pod. There's a transmitter aimed forward on the pod, there's a transmitter aimed aft on the pod, and in the middle of the pod is the voltage-controlled oscillator with its fancy modulation techniques. In that particular case, in order for the signal coming out of those antennas that are only a few, maybe a foot or two away from the actual voltage-controlled oscillator, that voltage-controlled oscillator is in a triple-shielded package. In other words, there's a complete package around a package around a package to make sure that you don't get feedback from the transmitter into that oscillator, because if you did, your transmitter system becomes one great big feedback network, if you know what I mean. So There they need something in the vicinity of 140 decibels of shielding, and they do achieve it, and it's measurable. W2RYY, K2RYW, great show.
So I guess you're testing the preamp under power. You're looking at the output of a spectrum analyzer, and what are you putting on the input? 50 ohm load?
The output of the amplifier I would have into a well-shielded piece of coax into a spectrum analyzer. The input could be a 50 ohm dummy load, or a source of signal, whichever you like, which again is well-shielded. Now you're putting in the signal that you're testing for leakage, and whether or not the leakage occurs, let's assume that it's a 432 preamplifier. And the 432 preamplifier, the leakage it has at 432, 431, 430, 433, 434, it's all going to be very, very close to the same. So by putting in a transmitter into your local sniffer at an adjacent frequency, like say 434, you can now easily pick out your jamming signal, your leakage signal on that spectrum analyzer versus the real signal you're feeding through at 432. So differentiating between external leakage and shielding requirements versus feed-through signal is pretty easy to do once you choose the right frequencies and the right kind of equipment and you know what you're doing. That kind of testing has been done very successfully in a repeatable manner. Now, for you and I to do that in our laboratory, we can get a rough test. I mean, the amplifier doesn't have to be in a perfect anechoic chamber. A good termination on the input, the spectrum analyzer on the output, and my sniffing signal held near the case, and I wave it around various areas in the case. If the case did have some leakage, I find out real fast in that manner, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW. And by the way, my further evidence that the Advanced Receiver Research preamp has nowhere near the proper amount of shielding is, first of all, experience with well-shielded circuits and what they look like. Second of all, the fact that you can ask around the ham radio network and you'll find out a large number of people have wanted a preamplifier on their repeater network on 2 meters or 440 megacycles, and they've attempted to use Advanced Receiver Research. A few guys have succeeded by putting another box around it to give it greater shielding, but the people who didn't do that, almost all of them did not succeed having enough isolation between the transmitter output and the preamplifier. They were not successful in incorporating that into their repeater system. W2RYY, K2RYW.
Okay, very good. I'll have to try and test it that way and see what I can come up with. Thank you.
Antonio, comment.
Yeah, once you do that, Joe, let us know what you find out. Go ahead, Rich. And by the way, Rich, do you know of anybody who used an AR² preamp on a repeater and it worked well for a long period of time? I think those are very rare circumstances. You got it, Rich. By the way, Rich, your audio is quite low, so shout into that microphone, please.
Okay, I don't know why my audio is low. Copy now, Vic. I raised my voice.
Yeah, you're almost up to the right volume now. Go ahead.
Okay, Vic. I use the ALR preamp in two cases. I don't normally case on a repeater. I use it on a Yaesu FT31 driving a old concert amplifier, which I modified to get about 500 watts out of it on 2 meters sideband. I also used it on a later on the Heathkit SB110 transceiver. It's a 6 meter transceiver at a new Vista Ferment, a 6CW4. Anyway, I did check sensitivity with my service monitor. I can plainly on sideband get down a 0.1 microvolt. Still hear the signal.
For a guy who's not running a repeater, that preamp does a beautiful job, which is the example you're giving. But in the case of a repeater, where you desire to transmit and receive simultaneously on the same nearby frequency, and you need to make sure you're not getting desensitization, you need 120 dB of shielding in the repeater service of that preamplifier. You will never get it. Never in a million years with that method of construction of the box. So, Your service is a fairly benign one, Rich, but a real repeater is a very tough service with the requirement to simultaneously transmit and receive with the same antenna in the same location. I'm going to go on to the next person now. Bob, KD2, November Victor Bravo, K2LIW. Go ahead, Bob. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to the net. This is KD2NVB. You probably remember I was on last week with a question about my mag loop inside my apartment with the hum interfering with the Kings County Radio Club 10-meter net, which the frequency was 28.380. Anyway, this should be short because I only have a little bit to add to last week. Let me drop. Yeah, today I just caught the very tail end of the 10-meter net. It ended early, and I didn't even get a chance to check in. But anyway, I did scan around. Hum is nowhere except right there at that frequency almost. It goes about, I go about 4 kc down, and it goes away. I go about 1 kc up, and it goes away. It's right there at that frequency. I tried other bands. Joe's suggestion last week about even, you know, whether it might be a harmonic of other things. I tried those things, the ones that I could get on my setup, and nothing. It was just right there. So that's really all I have to add. So maybe that helps a little. Maybe it doesn't. Back to you, Dick.
Bob, the signal you were listening to on 28 megafacals, was it an FM modulated signal? Go ahead.
No, it was single sideband, you know, upper sideband. It was a 10-meter net with the Kings County Radio Club, upper sideband at 28.380. Back to you.
Okay, that's very interesting. Only at 28.380 did you hear the hum. Was the hum there when the sideband signal was not there? Or was the hum there only when you're listening to a sideband signal? So if the sideband signal goes away, but you got the squelch open, did you hear the hum? Over to you, Bob.
I didn't change the squelch. Actually, I'm still a newbie with that. I didn't know what to do. But what I did realize, when the net ended and nobody was transmitting, yes, the hum was there. Always. There was nothing else on the frequency. Roy was gone. The net was over. And the hum was there, just like before. Back to you.
What you're calling a hum, I'm going to guess what you're listening to is a local oscillator re-radiating from some adjacent piece of electronics. Maybe it's the television set of a neighbor. Maybe it's a something on 14 megacycles and the second harmonic is coming out on 28. But from what you're describing, it sounds to me like it's something very locally being generated by various signal tracking, signal direction finding, and sniffing techniques. By using a piece of portable equipment, battery operated, that operates on 28 megacycles, that you can pick it up on, say, a whip antenna, and you start walking around the community and walking around the house, you're going to find out what the source is. I think it's a very local source that you can eventually pin down and eliminate if you want to. It's an interesting experiment, Bob. Is there a way you can get a hold of some kind of battery equipment, or your normal receiver, is the way you can operate it on a battery and run it portable on a whip antenna so you can go walking around the house and walking around the community with it and find out where the signal is strongest on that frequency? Over to you, Bob, K2LIW.
Okay, this is KD2ABB. Not with my present equipment, no. I mean, I have a, this is an ICOM 7100. It's what they call a mobile radio. So the whole thing weighs about 6 pounds. And I have a 5-pound BioNO battery. I wouldn't be very practical. I can see myself carting. And I don't have a whip antenna. Yeah, I couldn't do it with my present setup. What kind of thing would be the easiest, if I want to go this route, to purchase to do such a thing? Back to you.
Okay. Your mobile radio is not very heavy and it's portable, in my opinion. The battery that you'll be carrying with it, yes, the battery is kind of heavy, but that battery is good for some number of ampere hours. You don't need that much time. By putting together an array of D-cell batteries in series, making 12 or 13 and a half volts, so to speak, you could make a portable battery pack that would be good for an hour. That's about all you really need. And then any kind of a simple antenna connected to that mobile radio that picks up the hum would allow you to make it portable. Now you can walk around the house, walk around the neighborhood, and find out where the signal is coming from. So you can, you've got more than 50% of the equipment already in your hand that can make that a portable system. The antenna doesn't have to be very elaborate. But once you walk around with that, you're going to find out where it's coming from. So if you care to eliminate it, if it's bad enough to worry about it, Bob, that's a possible approach. KD2NVP, NVB, K2RIW.
Okay, so, I'm sorry, you mean walking around just around the house, which in my case is a small two-room apartment? I've done that already with just walking around the magnet antenna to some extent. I can do it more, though. I thought you kind of meant walking outside. Maybe you did mean that. Back to you.
When you walk around with the mag mount antenna in the house, it does get stronger in certain locations. Over to you, Bob.
Yes, as I said last week, it was basically, there's only about one spot where I can even really pick up the signal of the net. I mean, it's just a very bad location for an antenna that's inside this apartment. And where I have it is where both the signal, hearing mostly time Roy, a lot of the other people I don't hear at all, even then, that's where the hum is strongest, that's where the signal is strongest. The same position of the antenna, the same location. Go a little away from that, it gets a bit weaker in both instances, and then I have neither signal nor hum in the rest of the apartment. That's what I've discovered so far walking around. So I could try it a little more, but that seems to be what it is. Back to you.
Bob, your apartment is how many floors above the street?
It's a third floor apartment, so, you know, the floor is roughly 20-some feet above the ground.
Okay. And the building is probably giving you some shielding. So with that mag loop antenna, assuming it's portable or some other antenna that is portable, you could, with the flashlight battery, so to speak, and that mobile radio, you could walk around outside, up and down the block, and still hear the repeater, the net on 28 megacycles, and find out where the signal gets strongest. So walking around outside your house with that equipment in a portable manner will allow you to pin it down. My guess is it is some local source of signal. If you want to really make it go away, I think this would be an interesting, fox hunt, if you know what I mean. And maybe if there's other 28 megacycle sideband people in the neighborhood, maybe somebody would volunteer with their equipment to go along with you. There are certain kinds of handheld 28 megacycle sideband equipment. They're a bit rare, but a handheld handy-talkie on 28 meg that takes the sideband mode would certainly be very, very much fun to use in this case. Over to you, Bob, and let me know what you find out if you do get a chance to do that bunny hunting. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, yeah, I wouldn't do it with my present equipment because it's only about 20-some pounds or something. It'd be kind of unwieldy, but yeah. I'm wondering if that high-end Kenwood handy-talkie, I know it can receive, I think it can receive something like 10 meters, but I don't know if the antenna. Do you need an antenna that can receive the 10-meter signal? I assume you would to build a hunt for the noise at the same time. Is that true? Back to you, Dick.
There have been a number of very rare handy-talkie rigs that run on 28 megacycles and have single sideband capability. And they usually come with a rubber duck-like antenna on them. An antenna only has to resonate on the usable frequency. It doesn't have to be physically a quarter wavelength long. A quarter wavelength long would be 8 feet on 28 megacycles. Doesn't have to be. So a handy-talkie with this rubber duck that resonates and is forced into resonance by way of the antenna tuner built into the handy-talkie would do the job very nicely. As I said, it's rare. If you can find somebody that's got one of those and loan it to you, it would be fun to use. But with the equipment you've got, your mobile rig is not that heavy. With a strap over your shoulder, it would be easy to carry. A temporary battery setup made out of E-size flashlight batteries would supply enough power in the receive mode to run it. So you could make a portable piece of equipment. And the antenna you put on it, you can make up a homebrew rubber duck, or there's various kinds of antennas you could put on that mobile rig. And that whole system would be portable, and you need portability to pin down now where it's coming from. I am 95% positive that when you do this, you'll find out the source of the signal is within a block of your house. Over to you, Bob, K2RIW.
Yes, the guy had that feeling back, in fact, that it's only in my bedroom, which is where the signal's good too, and it could be in the apartment next door. I had the intuition feeling I had too, and it was very close to me, whatever it is. And then once I, of course, once I find out what it is, whether it's something I could do anything about or not is another question, but I guess it's just interesting to find out what it is for starters. So yeah, I'll think about that. Maybe I'll do some Googling and about the antenna thing or what have you. I'll keep checking this problem out. Back to you.
WB2AHK. WB2AHK. Recognized. Get you in a second. One quick question I've got for you, Bob. Every time you listen to that net at 28 megs, is the hum always there, always the same amplitude? If it's a piece of equipment that your neighbor is using, maybe only when it's going through that particular channel is the local oscillator giving you the grief. Is there ever a time when you've heard the desired signal when the hum wasn't there? Over to you first, Bob.
Dick, I don't think so. I think it's always there, and like I don't have... I don't know for sure, but I'm sure it's the same pitch. It sounds the same to me. I didn't check it with a piano. I don't have absolute pitch. But I'm sure it's the same. But an interesting note, I only do this on Sunday, you know, from 11 a.m. to 1 or 2 p.m., whatever, when the net's going on. One thing I will try is just turning it to that signal, that frequency, some other time of the week. And that would give me a clue. Is it something that somebody's only doing on Sunday, you know, rather than this thing happening all the time? So I will check that out. So back to you, Dave.
That's a good thing to do, Bob. Find out, is that signal on that frequency always there? WB2 AHK, I think it is. Tell us your name, sir, and your comment or question, K2RAW.
Hello, everybody. This is Chet, CHT. I could lend them a portable sideband, upper and lower sideband, 28 megacycle receiver. It's a handheld receiver with a whip on it, very, very sensitive, and it's called a PL-Epsilon. Tango, Echo, Charlie, Sugar, Uniform, Nancy, model P as in Peter, L as in London, 880. I have two of them. I can lend them one, and you can borrow it for a while. Over.
Hey, Bob, there's an offer that's hard to turn down. Whiskey Bravo 2 Alpha Hotel Kilowatt has the portable piece of equipment you need to do the bunny hunting. What's the easiest way that Chet can get a hold of you, Bob? Is there a phone number or an email, a web address, an email address that he can send to you so that you two can get together? KB2, November, Victor Bravo, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bob.
He can email me, Dick, he can email me, WB2AHK@AOL, and we can talk that way.
Did you get that, Bob?
I think it was WB2AHK Alpha Hotel Kilo, is that right?
Alpha Hotel Kilo at AOL is what he said. If you email him and you two get together, he's got the piece of equipment you need, and he's willing to loan it to you because he's down to his last two of them. Back to you, Bob.
Okay, very good. Whiskey, but two Alpha Hotel Kilo, is that it?
You got it. Whiskey, Bravo, 2, Alpha Hotel Kilo, at AOL. I presume it's at AOL.com or something like that. Over to you, Chet.
Yes, it's AOL.com. AOL.com. WB2 America Hotel Kilo at AOL.com. If he can get here and pick it up, I'll lend it to him. He can keep it for a couple of weeks. It's not a problem because I have two of them. Over.
AC2GS.
GS recognized. Chet, what is your QTH so that Bob knows how difficult it's going to be to get to you? Chet, go ahead.
I'm by Peter. I'm in Floral Park near Belmont Racetrack. Over.
Sounds easy to get to. Roy, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Dick. My understanding of ARRL domains is they don't use .com much. The email address for representatives of the ARRL at at ARRL.org, but club members who get a referral through that, it's ARRL.net, not .com.
The address he's giving is AOL, Alpha Oscar Lima. Over to you, Roy.
Oh, okay, pardon me. I thought he was saying the ARRL, but okay, he knows what AOL is. I'm sorry.
Okay, need any further information, Bob? Sounds like you guys going to get together, and he's got what you need. You don't even have to build the portable battery set with the flashlight batteries. Over to you, Bob, for any other comments or questions.
Great, I'll check it out. I will email. I got his own recording, but what was his first name again? And I hope he's on near a subway, but I don't have a car. But I can figure a way. So back to you.
Yeah, I think he said his name is Chet. Chester, is that true? AHK, go ahead.
Yes, Roger, Chet. That's Chet for Chester. We'll figure that out a way. Maybe somebody goes by Kings County area or wherever he's located. We'll figure something out. All in the figuring out. Over.
Okay, sounds like you've got a plan here, Bob. And so maybe by next week, you'll have a report as to what you found when you walked around with that handy-talkie. Back to you, Bob.
All right, very good. And thank you, Chet. And I will email you. And thank you, Dick. And thank you to the net. So I guess that's it for me. Thanks again. And I'll be here listening. And back to you, Dick.
Could you put me on the Antic? N2EO.
N2AEO, go ahead and shout into that microphone. Your audio is low.
Okay, I don't know why the audio is low. I will check it. First of all, I didn't get his name. Fellow with the interference. It could actually be anything. Even a wireless alarm system in his area. Almost anything, but I wouldn't neglect that. An alarm system. The problem is that dealing with the person could be a real problem. Maybe. Potentially. I had a neighbor. She plugged in an air conditioner. It didn't run. She left it plugged in. It turned out to be the witch was arcing. And Con Edison found it with a portable radio made by, I forget now. But, you know, she gave such a hard time. It was like we got her in trouble.
And let's not worry about that so much, Rich. Bob is a friendly guy. He's diplomatic. He's not going to insult the person as he gets near their house and finds out that a source of signal is giving grief. And with proper permission, he might even be able to have the person admit Bob to her house, so to speak, where he can walk around the house and find out where it's happening. What happens with radio equipment making interference is it strongly obeys the inverse square law. As you get closer to the source of the signal, it'll get louder and louder. So pinning it down by a bunny hunting technique is it's a skill, but it follows a lot of common sense. I think there's a high probability Bob's going to find out what it is, and I'll bet you the person with it won't give him a whole lot of grief. Let's not worry about that. Once he finds out what it is, then there's probably a way that it can be made to stop doing it. And with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2XCN. I have a question to you, if you don't mind.
Go ahead, Wes.
It's a subject that I have mentioned in last TechNet two weeks ago about cylindrical waves. And you said that cylindrical waves don't exist. They only exist in near field. They don't exist in far field. And to actually,
I certainly did say that. Every far field signal is a TEM, transverse electromagnetic. Every far field signal, when you're more than a few wavelengths away from the source, has a strongly defined E field and an H field that are exactly at right angles to each other, and they're exactly at right angles to the direction of propagation. So that is the only way radio really propagates at any realistic distance. real close to a wire antenna, yes, you may think you're seeing an E-field. And you could set up cylindrical coordinates for evaluating it in the reactive near field. But that's not the way it really propagates. In the real world of real propagation at any substantial distance, there is no cylindrical wave. Over to you, Wes. That's a strongly felt opinion of mine. K2RIW listening.
But the problem is that I didn't get any confirmation of that statement in the literature. The wave is emitted from line source, and the only line source can create wave fronts that are cylindrical. Do you agree with that?
No, I do not. Your line source could be a mile long. It could be at a wavelength of, let me pick a number, 10 meters. And you're standing a quarter of a mile away from it. You will see a purely TEM wave. That's the only thing that gets to you a mile away. By the time you're more than a few wavelengths away from that antenna, you will see a pure TEM wave. You will not see a cylindrical wave. So at a substantial distance, it does not exist. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Well, I agree that wavefront emerging from or collapsing into a point is spherical. We take cut off of that each one of the spheres in the far field, we have a plane wave. Do you agree with that?
In the far field, there is never anything but a plane wave. Now, whether you want to use in a point source a spherical coordinate system up real close, or a cylindrical coordinate system, or a Cartesian coordinate system, that's your choice. And if you're smart enough with the mathematics up close, you can make it work. But in the real far field, there is nothing but a pure flat wavefront TEM wave. That's all that really propagates into any substantial distance in space. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Well, actually what you're doing is you're talking about Schuiten principles, who in 1678 theorized that light propagation that claim each point on the propagating wavefront, and that regardless of shape, it could be assumed to be a source of new spherical waves. And the sum of those secondary spherical wavelets produced by subsequent wavefronts. Is that what you're talking about? Relate it to Fresnel and Kirchhoff and to XGM?
I'm strictly talking about radio. I'll admit that with light, there's all kinds of fancy things you can generate and fancy ways you can explain it. But a real wave at some number of wavelengths away from a source at a radio frequency. If I at a particular distance had an E field of 377 volts per meter, and the impedance of free space is 377 ohms, I can consider it like an EIIR situation, sort of which 377 volts divided by 377 ohms is 1 ampere. So when I make that measurement in the far field from an antenna, and if I happen to measure 377 volts per meter, I will measure an H field of 1 amp per meter. It's related by the free space 377. Those two fields, E field and H field, are exactly at right angles to each other, and that a substantial difference, that wavefront is a pure planar wave. TEM, E and H at right angles to the direction of propagation, following the pointing vector. That's what really propagates at radio frequencies. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
So I assume that the cylindrical coordinates must become smaller in time or in distance from this line source, as the point source is not able to create that, and that must happen in between the near field and to exist.
What your source is, if your source is a so-called point source, line source, planar source, no matter what the source is, when you are a certain number of wavelengths away from it, the only thing that's really propagating is a TEM planar wave. That's the only thing that really will propagate. Of course, you can use any set of coordinates you want to analyze it. But that's not what really happens at, let me pick a number. When you're 20 wavelengths away from your source, no matter what the hell the source is, it is a planar wave from GEM, OUS, K2RI,